You're listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast from Judicial Watch.
I'm Chris Farrell, and this is On Watch. Welcome to On Watch, everybody, the Judicial Watch podcast, where we go behind the headlines to report on news that the mainstream media would rather you not know about, where we try to recover some lost history, and we try to explain the inexplicable. And today, we have the very great privilege of having Dr. Eitan Haim with us. He's a general surgeon in Dallas. Dr. Haim, welcome to On Watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
The importance of having you on as a guest is to highlight what I consider to be really courageous actions as a whistleblower. You brought to light, you came forth and explained how one of the largest, if not the largest, children's hospital in America was involved in really illegal, unlawful, unethical pediatric sex change activities or programs. That's really the kickoff point, I think, to your story. There's more to it, but let's start with that, Doctor. What happened, and why did you decide to come forward?
Yeah, well, again, thank you for having me on, but just a little bit of background.
Sure.
During this time, I was a general surgery resident at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. You know, one of the best surgical programs in the country. And a residency is what you do after medical school when you're training in your chosen specialty.
Right.
It could be anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And part of the program, Baylor College of Medicine, you rotate at a number of different hospitals. So it could be Bentob, which is the county hospital where we do all the trauma, St. Luke's, which is a great tertiary care center. But we spend the most time at Texas Children's, which is the largest children's hospital in the world. And because of that, one of the most prestigious. And, you know, this was around 2021, 2022. I began to discover what they were doing to kids who believed they were transgender. I had always kind of known about it, but it seemed so far on the periphery, I never really thought about it. But
right.
It was during that time it became more prominent. And, you know, you think it's happening in other states like Washington or Oregon, but never in Texas. So while I was at the program as a surgical resident, in March of 2022, the hospital had issued a public statement unequivocally saying they were going to shut down the program because of the legal risks. And it's important to note that they said because of the legal risks. So they acknowledged that there was legal liability.
Right. There's jeopardy. There's exposure. Legal exposure for the hospital to continue doing these sorts of, I'll call them treatments. But that's what they were faced with.
Yeah, and I like to refer to them as interventions because a treatment has the implication that you're restoring an individual's
right.
health to its natural state,
right.
Whereas this is inducing a state of disease. So that's
There's nothing wrong to begin with, so why would you treat something that there's nothing
exactly.
wrong with?
But yeah,
I get it.
but this statement was in response to a opinion released by the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, saying that it could be investigated as child abuse. So of course the hospital wanted to cover themselves.
Sure.
They wanted to reduce their own liability. I imagine. I mean, it makes sense that they would release that statement. But I knew that this was a lie. And the reason is because I worked at the hospital. I did surgery there, and I knew the surgeons doing it. They had told me they were doing it. So in the months following that, other residents would come up to me and tell me that they had just implanted a puberty-blocking device into an 11, 12-year-old girl. They said how these kids had all these psychiatric problems, weren't being addressed. How these kids were very confident. They were sure that they were going to have more surgery in the future, how they never wanted to have children. You know, there were some situations where you had multiple family members who were transgender. All of this raises obviously red flags for anyone doing this procedure. It's horrifying to think an 11-year-old girl
right.
can't make these decisions. So, but it struck me as odd because this statement had come out a few months before, and they're still doing these procedures. Are, you know, but I couldn't believe that the hospital was lying to the public. It's just so crazy. It's so unbelievable to think that they would do that. So in the few months after that, now January of 2023, all doubt was eliminated from my mind because the directors of the program, the transgender program that supposedly did not exist, were given the opportunity to speak at the hospital's most prestigious lecture series. It's called Grand Rounds. It's a lecture where the hospital prioritizes, you know, certain subjects that they want to talk about. And in January, it was the transgender program. They talked about their algorithmic approach to treating these children, to intervening on these children with hormones, blockers. They talked about how general pediatricians should ask about gender identity behind the backs of their parents. In a Zoom conference with multiple members of the transgender program, with a group of medical students a few weeks after that, there was a social worker who said that she wouldn't document consults to the transgender program in order to avoid scrutiny from governing medical bodies. And she's just admitting this to a group of 150 medical students.
So let me, I have to interject at this point. How is it that these people are making these admissions in really a rather formal format or venue? They're discussing this program and what they're doing, and there isn't a general uproar. I mean, thank God for you, but why aren't there 100 other guys and gals like you saying, hey, wait a minute, I understand what you're doing, but it's objectively wrong. You're violating a Hippocratic Oath. You're engaged in this sort of boutique gender ideology experimentation. Stop. What are you doing? I mean, thank God for you, but why aren't there 100 other guys like you?
You know, it's a good question, and it's one of the most common questions. But when you're in that situation, if you really understand what it's like in these academic medical centers, it makes complete sense. And the reason is because there is this environment of absolute censorship where people who think differently don't ever speak their minds. And people who do speak their minds are going to suffer the most severe ramifications to their career. And for doctors who sacrifice a lot, you know, it's a big deal for them. So this was known by hundreds of people at the highest levels of the hospital. They not only continued the program, but they just expanded. And that's why it took me so long to really make that realization.
Sure.
It's hard to believe. But once it became clear what was happening and there was no denying it, that's when I knew I had a responsibility as an individual, but a professional responsibility as a surgeon to do something. So that's when I started reaching out to journalists in January of 2023.
Right.
And even that, I mean, I spent months trying to find journalists. Most of them just didn't even believe me. I would just, you know, send emails to all these organizations you would think would be interested in something like this. You know, because I'm some random person, they probably thought, you know, I'm a nobody, or like, why listen to him? But also, it's just hard to believe.
Right, right. So you make this disclosure. I mean, you're a whistleblower in every sense of the word, and sort of the common vernacular, you're one, but you're also one legally. And so you make these disclosures and you say, hey, look, these people are involved in, at a minimum, unethical and probably, I'll just say unlawful. I don't know that I want to say criminal, but certainly unlawful conduct. And then there's the public trust that's broken. All these healthcare providers, whether they're actual MDs or whether they're administrative professional healthcare staff, not doctors, but, you know, public officials, they've lied. They've gone out and told the public something that they know is 180 degrees opposite. And so they've broken the public trust, the largest children's healthcare hospital. I mean, this should be devastating. There should be inquiries being conducted, board of governors convened, firings. You know, it should have been a whole house cleaning. Did any of those things happen?
Well, So Chris Rufo released a story in mid-May of 2023.
Right.
And it was perfect timing. I mean, it was I believe, divine providence.
Sure.
It was too good of timing to be anything else, I believe. But I didn't know this at the time, but Texas was voting on a bill called SB 14, like a week and a half after I got in touch with Christopher Rufo. This was the bill that was going to ban all of these interventions, hormones, blockers, in children. And we felt like if we get the story out, it may have an impact.
Right.
So we go through the verification process, get the story out on May 16th, 2023, one day before. It's in all the major headlines, but the story does exactly what we hoped it would. A day later, that bill was passed with bipartisan support. There were Democrats who voted in favor of it because our story came out one day before.
Right.
They didn't know these things were happening in their districts. But then another whistleblower comes out who worked with these doctors, who describes the horrific experience of seeing these kids started on hormones blockers after 20, 30 minutes without them understanding what was happening. And then a few days after that, the Attorney General announces an investigation into the hospital.
Good.
But, and then the CEO says he's going to shut down the program. But I don't have much faith because, well, at least now, I'm a little skeptical. Because even since I've taken my story public because of what we'll talk about soon, there's been what we found a odd lack of interest from Texas politicians. And I think it's probably not a mystery as to why, because Texas Children's donates a lot to a lot of these people. So,
yeah, it's all money. Maybe. It's all funding. I mean, we've seen the pervasive and really corrosive effect of dollars and cents, obviously, with politicians. But frankly, even in medical practices, right? I mean, Pfizer Absolutely. Was running around incentivizing medical practices to dose people up with their vaccine for COVID. So if you were running I know this, I won't tell you how I know it, but I know it. A small family practice, like three or four docs in a good-sized community, they've got hundreds of families and patients coming into them. And if they could show high vaccination rates, a check came in. I mean, it's a payoff. I don't care. You can describe it as an incentive, there's all kinds of language and double talk you can use. But the same is true also even with hospitals when it came with putting people on ventilators. I mean, it's a nightmare, but there's a lot of dirty money in this. And it looks like, based on, these are my words, not yours, but my interpretation is there's enough really dirty money in this to influence the politicians not to be too terribly interested anymore. They did sort of a demonstration, and now they're done, and they're not gonna pursue it.
And I think that's maybe a good way to describe it, like a demonstration, and then without. But I want to reserve judgment because I do feel that there are a lot of politicians in Texas who are really good.
Yeah.
Really good people. And a lot of them are just maybe understaffed because there's so much going on, especially with other issues in Texas border that granted, there's limited capacities. But to go back to your point about the money,
right?
These puberty blockers, do you know how much it costs for one of these?
I have no idea. I'm sure it's outrageous.
Yeah, like $30,000+.
I mean, nothing surprises me, but, I think that really goes to a question I was going to ask you a little bit earlier, but I didn't want to interrupt you, is that who is driving this? This whole transgender phenomenon is like a mind virus. It's this latest obsessive thing where suddenly everybody's has gender dysphoria. Everybody's born in the wrong body. Everybody requires some kind of chemical intervention or surgery. It is like a fixation. And I think there's an upward trend where people get sucked into this and they start believing that they aren't who they're supposed to be. But I have to believe, again, there's money behind it. So what's the driving force on this?
Well, I think that there's a few driving forces. Since 2020 with COVID, the medical profession had moved towards a ideology-driven practice versus a evidence-based practice, where the recommendations that doctors would make would not necessarily be what was based on the best evidence or even basic therapeutic rationale, but rather it was driven by what experts would say. It was based on, which was based on an ideology, you know, and especially with this.
Right.
And because COVID became so prevalent, it held so much power, it laid the groundwork for the transgender ideology to really proliferate. Because it was only after 2020 that you saw all these gender clinics started arising. So that's one driving factor. But then I believe that there's also people in the hospital, right, in the administration level who they don't probably don't agree with this ideologically. Many are even conservatives. Actually, I know that they're conservative, but they see the dollar signs and the money is so, the returns are so high. Because think about what happens when you start a patient who's 11 years old on this path, they're going to be a chronic medical patient for the rest of their lives.
I mean, let's pause right there. They're going to be a chronic medical patient for the rest of their lives.
And that's not me saying that. That's by their own standards and their own protocols.
Yeah, I mean, but just everyone needs to pause and think about that. So you have a teenage kid, or in this case, not even teenage, 11, and they start down this path, and they never get better. They're never done. They're never at some kind of like, okay, well, we've done the best we can, and that's the end of the game. These people are subject to medical issues, to complications, to problems, whether it's actual, I guess, the functioning of their body mechanically, or whether it's something cosmetic. They're on this forever arc of medical care.
Yeah, and what's even more terrifying is that it is rapidly accelerating. So the more time they're on this road, the farther they go down, the faster they travel, because these problems start compounding. And after a certain point, there's no going back to even any semblance of who they once were.
Right.
Because the changes to your body become so profound that there's no going back. And there's some point where I imagine so many of them wake up and think, you know, what's happened to me? They look in the mirror and they can't recognize a person.
Right.
And then they come to the realization that, well, the people who were supposed to take care of me, the people who were supposed to love me, were the ones who had thrown me to the wolves.
Right.
And
right.
We ask ourselves why the suicide rate, you know, why the mental health issue is so bad, why so many people try to kill themselves in this group.
Right.
And I think at this point, the answer is obvious.
Yeah, you know, this is a case where, and this may be why, I'm sure I'm committing all sorts of mortal sins even saying this, but this may be a case where someone has, you know, either an emotional disturbance or a mental disorder of some type. And I know people don't like saying disorder, but there's a dysphoria, we'll use that word, where, you know, they're having emotional and mental issues with a particular subject, a part of who they are. They're not integrated and they're fully integrated. But I mean, there's ways to address and deal with that, in my opinion. And I'm no doctor, but I know enough about people who have various emotional or mental disorders, and you know they seem to be doomed to a path of life, whether it's depression or drug or alcohol abuse or other things that people struggle with, and they work through it. And it may not be perfect, and it may not be pretty, but there's a way to sort of work through it without getting an 11-year-old and doing life-altering surgery. I mean, it's such a severe, radical act. I really don't know how. I mean, I understand the dollars and cents of it, but I don't understand how, whether you're a doctor or whether you're in some other capacity, you could be a nurse, how you can stand by and watch this stuff.
Yeah, and that was a horrifying thing, because you think, you know, if you love these kids, if you love these people, then you have to allow them to confront these issues,
right,
to get through them. It's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. But there's something worth learning, that when you go through puberty, it's hard. It's painful. You're going to look weird. You're going to feel awkward. You're going to be insecure.
Right.
But these lessons are things you take into adulthood. This is your path into becoming the person you'll always be. And it's only through that process will you be able to be a part of the most meaningful part of living, which is having a family and having children. And we're saying, well, you know what? That doesn't mean anything. And then you could just avoid all that issue just by taking this pill or getting this injection. And you can avoid all of it. And I don't think that's doing anything good. And it's so obvious that's not.
But yeah.
That's why I felt, I mean, I couldn't, because everyone else thought it was just, oh, it's just what we do, right? That's what the institutions of medicine say. That's what everyone in the hospital is saying, despite the fact that they were lying. We just go on with it. Like, I knew for a fact, this is not right. This is not okay.
Right.
As a doctor, I have a responsibility to do something about it.
Yeah, I just think of, you know, I can think of even family members of mine, a female family member, a cousin who was sort of, you know, people thought of her as a tomboy. She was very much a lady and grew up in a conventional, normal, whatever life. But as a young teen, she loved playing baseball, right? Well, that, you know, tomboy was the terminology thrown at her. It didn't affect or change who she was or her identity. So, I mean, I guess in this scenario, if a young lady, a young girl, likes playing baseball or is too, I guess, I don't know. It just seems like an ordinary sort of development, physical and psychological development of awkward teens. And it goes the other way as well. It could be a guy who some people think is too sensitive or too whatever. It's simply a phase. It's part of human development. There's nothing, you know, wrong or diseased about it. It's just another step in how we go through life.
Yeah. And it's so hard to even wrap your head around what's happening, which is why I believe it's been allowed to go on for so long, because really so many people don't even believe it's happening.
Yeah.
Even people, like conservative people,
yeah,
don't even know how bad it is.
I think that's part of the problem, is people think, oh, that's some oddball, you know, one in a million situation, and it's being exploited by the media, but it's really incredibly rare. And sadly, it's not. It's becoming more and more.
Yeah.
Let me,
and integrated into all of the biggest hospitals in our country.
Yeah. I mean, that's, if every large hospital is involved in this, we have a very grave problem. Doctor, you were brave enough to step forward and do this, but then there's actually a second, kind of, in my view, a second scandal or wave of corruption that comes after you. You have enough guts and enough dignity and sense to come forward and say, whoa, stop. But then all of a sudden, the eyes are all now turned on you. What happened to you?
Yeah. And when the story came out, I was just an anonymous whistleblower. So no one knew who I was. You know, my identity was anonymous. So, you know, the story comes out, everything happens, but my life just went on as normal.
Right.
Right. Everything goes quiet. So a month later, in June of 2023, a month after the story came out, I was getting ready to graduate from my surgical residency. I had a job lined up. You know, I was getting ready to move on to this next chapter of my life.
And, right.
It was Friday, June 23rd, 2023. And it was the day of my graduation. And, you know, so this is a really important day. You sacrifice so much,
yeah,
during those previous 5 years, that the day you graduate is a really big deal.
Yeah,
you know,
you're finally launching into your own professional career.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You carry the responsibility as a surgeon, and you're there and you're celebrating with all of your attendings, your co-residents, your family.
Sure.
So I was getting ready for the ceremony. It was around 11, 12 early afternoon. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm in my apartment, and all of a sudden I get an aggressive knock on the door. And I shuffle over, open the door, standing outside are two federal agents. They show me their badges and tell me they're with Health and Human Services, and they're investigating a case regarding medical records. And at that moment, you just kind of completely shut down. But I knew in some deep part of my being that I knew exactly what this was about.
Sure.
You know, we had challenged the predominant ideology of the regime, and we were able to do so effectively. This law got passed a day later.
Right.
Another whistleblower came out.
Right.
If doctors were able to do that, then who knows what else they could do, how else they could speak out. So they needed to make an example out of me. So there was a part of me that knew that. But of course, you kind of just freak out in the moment. Being in the doorway was very awkward. So I invite them in. We sit down and exchange some small talk. But they wanted to do an interview with me. So, you know, I kind of reluctantly say, okay. They start setting up a tripod. But my wife comes out. And an important part of the story, which will play a part later, is she had been hired as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Texas. So she's brilliant, brilliant lawyer. But she was undergoing a background check at the time. But they don't know this. You know, this is, it's just important to know. So she sits down. We look at each other, and we're like, ah, you know, so we knew we had to discuss this privately. So we go to our bedroom, and
sure.
We both agree, bad idea to talk to them without an attorney present.
Agree, 100%.
I go.
Which is a good lesson for everybody else watching this. If
yeah.
two federal agents arrive at your door and you haven't sought them out, they just arrive to talk to you, don't have a discussion unless your lawyer is present. That's
yeah.
like 99.999% of the time. Always get a lawyer and tell them you're happy to cooperate once your attorney's present. That's it.
Yeah. So we go back out to and tell them, and they say, okay, yeah, no problem.
I'm sure they were very disgruntled.
Yeah. Of course, I'm sure they would have loved me, for me to. But I know they were there to intimidate me,
sure.
for me to admit to something that never happened, so that I could just make this all go away. But before leaving, they hand me a target letter, and I had no idea what that was. But for the people who also don't know, it's just a piece of paper that informed me that I was a potential target of a criminal investigation, and it was signed by a assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Texas, and it was from the United States Department of Justice.
Right.
So a few minutes after that door opens, that door closes, and we knew that our lives had changed. And, you know, we knew that they were there to intimidate. We knew that they were there to instill fear, and we knew they wanted me to admit to something so they can make an example out of me, because it was obviously clear that there was nothing we had done that was illegal.
Of course.
Right? No criminals. And if anything, well, of course, the situation is that we had exposed something that was potentially criminal.
Correct.
So, you know, if we were to give in, we would just be giving in to a corrupt system. So they wanted to intimidate and instill fear. But that day, and as they're coming to realize now, they had knocked on the wrong door, because that day we decided to fight back.
Amen. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, and thank God. I mean, you're obviously a very nice guy who's like, all right, well, what do you want to talk about? And thank goodness for your very smart wife who said, one moment, please.
And, you know, the funny thing is, so we thought, well, what do we do? I have the graduation in a couple of hours. Like, you know.
Yeah.
So we opened a few bottles of champagne. We sat on our patio. We drank and we listened to like Vietnam War music and planned our war strategy, right?
So,
yeah, and then we went to our graduation ceremony, had a great time, and you know, we've been fighting ever since. But I mean, we have nothing to hide. I mean, it's there should be no reason for us to feel that, for me to feel like I didn't do anything wrong. So I have nothing to hide.
Exactly,
no,
ladies and gentlemen, this is the lesson of your federal government in action. You know, the powers that be with a lot of dollars and a lot of influence and connection are embarrassed because they get caught lying. And the result is They go out to the one honest man in the whole operation and try to do an intimidation shakedown on him. There's your lesson right there. But obviously, this target letter was a big zero. Nothing happened. But go ahead. Fill in the blanks there.
Yeah. So after the agents left, I get on the phone with Chris Ferrufo, who is a hero, by the way. This guy is...
He is.
I mean, in person and on an individual level, he's just as honest and brave and loyal as he appears in the public eye.
And a very smart guy.
Brilliant. So I call him, tell him the situation. He's like, all right, don't worry. I'm going to clear the rest of my day. I'm going to give you a call back. So he texts me a couple minutes later with the name of a lawyer. Her name is Marcella Burke. And I would come to find out that she was a partner at this big law firm. And she, you know, making like seven-figure salary, a bunch of money, but had quit because she didn't want to put pronouns in her bio. No joke. That's real. So she
It's just crazy.
She led an exodus of other conservative attorneys to start her own law firm, like very prestigious law firms. They all left to start her own law firm. And this was 6 months before my story came out. So they were connected through the same kind of network of prominent conservatives, because Marcella is a prominent conservative.
Right.
And I remember the conversation that she tells me, where Rufo calls Marcella and she said, you know, he says, like, hey, I have this person, this whistleblower, you have to defend this guy. You have to help him out. And she's like, I don't know if I could do it. We just started this law firm. Like, we're not in a position. But then he says, like, if not you, then who? And, you know, Marcella, she's like this, like, Shiite Catholic, rosary in one hand, middle finger in the other, bulldog attorney. So she, you know, Rufo was speaking to, like, her inner, you know, her inner being. So she heard the voice, you know. Yeah. She was like, I don't have an option. So,
yeah.
But we talked to her. We knew she was the right person, because she knew this was just as much as it was like political as it was legal, because there was no legal issue here, right? We had exposed this was a whistleblower case. So our attorney, we formed our legal team. They reached out to the prosecutor's office in the Southern District of Texas. And over the next couple of months, you know, I call it like a state of legal purgatory.
Yeah.
Where, you know, a lot is happening, but nothing's happening. But what I come to find out is there is a profound degree of corruption. So when I went public with my story in January of 2024, the reason I did is because of this corruption that was very apparent. And, this corruption is outlined in a letter my attorneys had written to Congress, because what they experienced was so bad that they themselves felt obligated to blow the whistle on what this prosecutor was doing.
Right.
And just to name a few of those things, and all of this is written in the letter, and because of that, I can comment on it. So the first thing is, when they originally reached out to the prosecutor, she didn't know anything about the case. She didn't know the details of it. She didn't know what happened. She didn't know what she was going to investigate, like what criminal statute she was investigating, which means that everything's being run by these agents from HHS.
Right, right.
And HHS is profoundly ideologically driven. So this would be like starting a murder investigation without checking to see if the person's still alive, right?
Yeah. I mean, it makes me wonder, these HHS IG agents, did they have some fill-in-the-blank form with her signature at the bottom where they could go around dropping target letters on people? Anybody they didn't like, they dropped a target letter on? I mean, what it sounds like.
Yeah, and within 4 weeks, a typically sclerotic, slow-moving organization like HHS is able to show up to my apartment in 4 weeks after... So they mobilize all their resources, right, do an investigation, find out it was me, and then show up to my apartment 4 weeks later.
Keep in mind, HHS is the same department that has an office called ORR, which is responsible for resettling unaccompanied alien children in the country. And ORR, part of HHS, they have lost upwards of 100,000 children in this country. They have no idea where they are. So they lose 100,000 children just sent out into the country to people pretending to be their guardians or relatives. No accountability whatsoever. But they find you in, like, bang, 4 weeks, and they're ready to give you a target letter.
You know, I didn't know that, but that's crazy. Yeah, it's like, why don't they spend their time looking for these lost kids instead
exactly.
of
Go
looking
out,
for whistleblowers?
Right. Go out and find children that are being trafficked and used in all kinds of horrific ways. Go spend your time on that, not going after you for telling the truth.
Yeah, and another thing that happened during those initial conversations is that the prosecutor had brought my wife into it, right? We had never told any of these people that my wife was undergoing a background check. So even though she didn't know anything about the case, nothing about the facts or what she was going to investigate, she says, well, you know, Andrea, my wife, isn't going to have a problem with a background check unless she starts to become difficult. And
right, this is Stalinist tactics. I mean, this is Stalin 101.
Yeah, yeah. And she says, it goes on over next couple of months saying, you know, that I had no right to blow the whistle as a doctor. So it's like, you know, it seems to me, here's this prosecutor who has a very limited understanding of the boundaries of her job, right? It's like dealing with like a first-year law student
right.
at some activist university.
Right.
Someone who thinks that they can use their position to go after their political enemy. And they want to lecture me on what I should be doing as a doctor. Like that, it's so profoundly offensive.
Yeah, it's off the charts, and it also ignores, like, if that person spent like 10 minutes on the internet, they'd understand what your oath is and what your duty and your obligation is. And I mean, this is just, it's either willful ignorance or stupidity. I don't know which one, but it's absurd.
Willful ignorance, stupidity, or malevolence.
Right, right.
Which I would surmise it is. And that's the list goes on. The degree of abuse can be, you know, you can read in that letter, but after experiencing it for those few months, because we didn't really know what to do, we had to spend all of our money. I mean, like hundreds of thousands of dollars, because we knew we had to fight back.
Right, right. Right.
And I'm not saying that like as like, oh, like look at me, poor guy. Like, I mean, that was the best investment I've ever made, because to spend this money to make that sacrifice in order to fight back is one of the greatest things I've ever done.
Amen.
Because if we don't do it, then we're just passing this fight along to our children.
Exactly.
But I knew that at some point I had to go public and tell people this story, because there was this kind of this thought emerging in my mind. It was becoming clear what was happening. Like, people like me in my situation, we grew up in a different United States, a different Department of Justice, where we kind of believed in it. We believed it was legitimate.
Yeah.
Where people didn't target whistleblowers like this. So because of this false belief, people in my position had always thought that if this does happen to them, their innocence is their greatest defense. That if they interact with the Department of Justice in a thoughtful way, that their innocence will be their greatest defense. Like, they will ultimately be vindicated. But they don't realize that when they interact with the corrupted Department of Justice, it is because they're innocent, because they're virtuous, that they're being targeted in the first place. That the point is not to pursue justice. The point is to destroy the person who's being targeted, to destroy their political enemies.
Right.
And obviously, this is what that is. It sounds very extreme, but I mean, how many other cases have we seen where this happened? And like, when you see it happen over the past 3-4 years play out, like, you see these textbook cases of political prosecution, right? At this point, I would be a fool to think it's going to be any other way.
You are exactly correct.
they operate most effectively, most discreetly in the shadows. So the only way to defend myself is to tell this story publicly. Because if people can hear the story publicly, the corruption becomes self-evident. But then we can also have the opportunity to take the fight back against them.
You're right. You're 100% correct. And thank God you did all these things. So this letter from your attorneys goes to Congress. Based on my background reading, it seems that Chip Roy, Congressman Chip Roy, and Congressman Jim Jordan have been on the receiving end of these communications. Have they been helpful or provided you with any assurance that something's going to happen here?
Well, you know, I understand it's a process, so, you know, we're being patient. We're making our best efforts to try to push it through. But, you know, we're hoping, not really, but we still have faith in them.
Doctor, you are a good man. You really are.
Yeah.
You have to be.
They're busy. They got other things.
Yeah, they're busy. I know they're busy. I've dealt with these people in Washington, D.C. for 25 years. I know how busy they are.
Yeah,
I get it. Believe me. But the good news is.
Yeah, but we're working on it, you know, because we have to push it through.
Yeah.
And, because, no, this is something that we're not going to give up on.
Yeah, you are winning this by doing podcasts like this, other ones, interviews for other media. That's how you're winning the story. And,
and that's the other thing too. With we are raising money for a legal fund. It's a giftsendgo.com/Texas_whistleblower. And this is not only to help cover the existing legal costs, but to push this case forward for offensive action.
Yes.
Because this case doesn't mean anything unless we go on the offensive to hold these people accountable for what they've done. Because people on our side of the fence, we always are so quick to talk about these issues in such great detail and, describe these crimes very eloquently.
Right.
But when is it that the consequences are congruent with the crimes we describe? At some point, we have to make sure there's consequences when people do something that is unjust.
I agree with you 100%. So give us a recap. Now you're in Dallas area, and you're a general surgeon doing your medical work there. You're no longer affiliated with the Houston situation. What has either the Justice Department or HHS said to you? Where has that been left off?
I'm a busy surgeon in a small town outside Dallas. That's why I was initially late to this meeting by 15 minutes.
You have the best excuse there is. Don't worry about it.
I apologize for that. But, I've been able to work, but we haven't heard anything.
Nothing.
So, I have no idea.
My impression, my read on that is that between your attorneys, who have obviously done an excellent job representing you, and also the exposure that this has had in the media and then communications with Congress, that they know that they don't dare press against you or your wife in any way. So, and I think if they're stupid enough to do so, they do it at great peril, that they will be calling fire legally and bad publicity on themselves in such a way that they don't want that kind of attention. You know what I mean? In my experience, and I've had lots of experience dealing with whistleblowers who've been involved with the Department of Justice, whenever we would expose or reveal something that was going on, they became hysterical and ran for the shadows. They don't want to discuss any of this stuff. So sunshine is the best disinfectant here.
Yeah, and it's like I said before, they had knocked on the wrong door because
right.
It's one of those things where there's a lot of things in the works behind the scenes that we haven't gone public with yet, but at some point will be public.
Good.
There's one thing where there's a few things, but after these agents came to my apartment in the few days after that, I started getting very negative reviews on my doctor, review website.
Oh yeah. That's the other part of this is the smear campaign. They're going to try to do everything they can to say you're unethical and you're a bad doctor and you're, you know, whatever they can come up with, whatever they dream up, they will try to put some kind of negativity in the public sphere against you. And anybody watching this should know the polar opposite's true.
And the funny thing is in the language they used in their reviews was very similar to an article that Rufo had released before that had me as an anonymous doctor at a big medical center. And this is a part that I hadn't mentioned, but 2 days before the agents came, I had done an article with Rufo where I was just an anonymous doctor, and he just wanted my thoughts on the whole transgender thing.
Right.
And the article, we thought it was going to get a tiny bit of traction, but it actually got more than like 10 million views.
Wow.
Yeah, and the language in the reviews was the same as the language in the article was similar to the language in the reviews. So I had a feeling that this was from a left-wing activist that had found out about this investigation from either one of three organizations, TCH, Texas Children's, Health and Human Services, or the Department of Justice. So they must have leaked my name to some left-wing activist.
Guaranteed.
Which is a huge scandal. But so when we saw these reviews, what we decided to do was subpoena and get information from these websites, which we did.
Good.
We got an IP address. We have now narrowed it down to a physical location and are very close to identifying the individual who's responsible. And what it's going to be explosive once we really find out, because I'm not going to say where this is, but it is in a place where if we think it is who we believe it really is,
right,
it's going to be a big problem for them.
Good. And I hope that you're very successful in pursuing that, walking that back, and identifying it with certainty. And also, you know, there's somebody writing checks to pay them also, right? There's funders behind that. And, you know, really, in my experience, there's nothing more vicious than the sort of the lefty Twitterverse is my old expression for it. But there's people out there who do nothing. It's their paid job to post obnoxious lying. There's a wonderful old-fashioned word. You never hear it anymore. It's called calumny. Calumny is false swearing to destroy someone's reputation. And there's people that engage in calumny, you know, it's their job. They go online and they post stuff and they just try to destroy people's reputations. And I hope you're very successful in tracking that down.
Yeah, and I think that for so many people on our side, this has been able to proliferate without consequence. And I know we realize that our politicians, for the most part, aren't going to do anything about it. They're going to make big, grand statements.
Right, and forget
about
it.
For the most part, many of them are spineless cowards.
Yep.
Right? It's not going to be them who do it. It's not going to be big names in the media. Right? So it's up to individual, random people like me who have zero resources, but who refuse to give in. And I think what I'm coming to realize is that there is a world of people out there who are just looking for a fight to be a part of.
Yep.
They're looking for something to get behind because the people who are supposed to represent them have done nothing. So now we have a chance to do something, and we're going to do it without question.
That's great. That is what you're describing is an old 1970s political term, the silent majority. And they really are. They're out there. They're not running around screaming. They're busy, like, going to work, paying the mortgage, getting the kids to school. They're busy leading their lives and trying to be productive, law-abiding, tax-paying citizens. They're not lunatic activists, right? And so they're busy, but they're offended, right? They've got a core set of values. And when they hear a story like this, it cuts against everything they've ever believed in, and it aggravates them. And this gives them a great opportunity to contribute to what you're doing. And so when we post this interview, we'll put a link to your legal defense fund and your social media so that people can follow you and what they're doing. And if they're so inclined, and I hope they are, that they can choose to make a donation to support what you're doing. Because you put it on the line, right? There's a lot of people who would just run and hide. And you didn't do that. You put it on the line. You got a lot of guts.
And for people to know, every dollar that goes to that fund goes to the legal fund, goes to offensive action and defensive action.
That's great.
To set a precedent to protect whistleblowers in the medical community, but also offensive action to go after the people who should be held accountable. So, like, we're broke, but we're going to stay broke probably for a long time. But we're okay with that. None of that money goes towards us. We're going to be broke for a long time. We've accepted that. It is what it is, you know? So it's just important for people to know that that's where the money's going.
Well, contrary to that, I hope you have an outrageously successful medical practice and you have a ton of money. You deserve it.
Yeah. Well, that goes towards legal fees, too.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to give you a last blurb here for anything that I may have missed or I should have asked that I didn't, or just something that you want to say. Give us sort of your closing thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, I would say the last thing is that people have to understand that if we don't stand up in this fight now, oftentimes people make this calculation like, I can't say something or do something now because I have to keep my job, I have to pay my mortgage, I have to get my kids through college. So they believe they're holding back, they're not fighting in order to take care of their family. But what's happening is that when you don't fight, you're just passing that fight along to your children. So you're just putting them into a situation in the future that's going to be much more difficult, much more dangerous than the one it is now. So if we don't take on this challenge at this point in time, then you're just passing everything on to your children, and that's not taking care of them. So we have to fight at the moment. So that's the message I would pass along to people. The most important thing.
You are exactly correct, and I appreciate you're a brave guy, and you're exactly what I would hope, a doctor should do, and you're a tremendous example to people, and that don't have to be a surgeon to do this. You can do this as a government employee, hopefully as a teacher, as a whatever your profession, whatever your vocation in life. When you see something that's objectively wrong, you can't stand by with your hands in your pockets and kind of turn around and stare off in the distance. When you know it, you have guilty knowledge, and you have to act on it. You can't stand by and just pretend you don't know. That's how people end up being persecuted or killed or abused. We just can't do that as Americans. We can't.
Yeah, people will have to live with that shame and that guilt for the rest of their lives, and yes. People don't think it's going to eat them up, but it will.
Yep.
But if you stand up and do the right thing, you pass on to this world where you go into a place that's unknown, but I can assure you that the grass is really greener on the other side, because for the first time in your life, you'll be able to live with dignity.
Dr. Eitan Haim, thank you so much for your time. Thanks also to your wife, who's a brave lady. And we wish you the very best, and God bless you.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Farrell, On Watch.
Thanks for listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.